Woo. Welcome, everybody. It's another episode of Does It Matter?
And we're live.
We are live, and we are going to talk about things that are surprising in various ways.
Yeah, today's episode, at least for me, is about being wrong-footed.
I've got one of those.
It's a phrase that I like. It's very, like, I don't know, visual. But
having the feet on the wrong sides.
Or just like, oop, nope, that was not supposed to go there, and down I go. How are you on this lackadaisical Monday afternoon?
Oh, you know, I'm getting rolling.
Yeah. That's me too. Okay. Well, shall we?
We shall.
Do you want to go first, or shall I?
Why don't you?
Okay. So when I first thought about this topic, I thought about this example. This was kind of like the go-to for me, because while I myself was not particularly surprised by it, part of its reputation is that it was surprising. And I kind of want to lead into that by pulling a quote from a book. It's not an exact quote, because I don't have the book with me, but it's as close as I can remember it. And the book is part of a series that's like 1001 blank to do before you die. I like lists and general information, so even though like I have a quibble with a number of those particular lists, I do have a couple of those books. I have the movie one, and the book one, and the album one. And this is from the album one. And it's in reference to the album Swordfish Trombones by Tom Waits. And it's, even Tom Waits himself, a man very partial to obfuscation, admits that his career is divided into two halves, before Swordfish Trombones and after. So first let's talk about before a little bit. So Swordfish Trombones was his seventh, I think, album. It came out in 1983. His first album came out in 1973. It was Closing Time on Asylum Records. And he had a few more after that, the last of which was Heart Attack and Vine in 1980. And across these five or six albums, he kind of developed, in his words, a cocktail lounge maudlin crying in your beer image that was like mostly based around him being at a piano with some like kind of string arrangements in the background, light blues and jazz influence, characters being kind of down on their luck, like that sort of barfly lounge sort of vibe and feel. But a couple of things happened in 1980. He was working on the soundtrack to a Francis Ford Coppola movie, One from the Heart, and about this time is when he met Kathleen Brennan, I think is her name, a screenwriter whom he married, and whom he credits as having a very large influence on his music. Among other things, she introduced him to Captain Beefheart, apparently. And so when recording his next record, which was for a different record label, he changed from Asylum Records to Island Records, and I'm not sure, sort of the legend goes that the content of the album had something to do with that. I couldn't find anything that necessarily verified that. But the apocryphal story is that Island heard Swordfish Trombones and was like, what? No. Or Asylum, rather. And so Island was like, yeah, we'll do it. But, so the approach that he talked about for this record, and this is a quote that I pulled off Wikipedia from something called Tom Waits Instruments. I'm not really sure exactly what that is, but I like the quote. He said, "Your hands are like dogs, going to the same places they've been. You have to be careful when playing is no longer in the mind but in the fingers, going to happy places. You have to break them of their habits or you don't explore. You only play what's confident and pleasing. I'm learning to break those habits by playing instruments I know absolutely nothing about, like a bassoon or a waterphone."
It's such a Tom Waits thing to do.
I know. So the first track on Swordfish Trombones is called Underground. And when you put the needle down on it, it conjures up this image that... I'm going to try and describe like the image that it gives me in my head, and I don't know if that'll work. But like sometime in the like late 80s, the Henson Company did a kind of film noir parody thing called Dog City. I have tried to find this. Like, we had it on a VHS tape as a kid. I have tried to find it as an adult and been unable to do so. I don't think I dreamed it. But it was a very, like, kind of, like, shrouded in mist and grimy, like, detective-y kind of story with, like, a lot of bright, colorful puppet characters. And, Underground kind of sounds like that. It's got a clank and a cronk and a like a very Kurt Weill, the old one, not the new one, the German one, is like a big influence on the work on this record. Reportedly also draws influence from like a lot of like old tango music, obscure early country, working in kind of like more strange rhythms, a lot heavier of a blues influence, more abstract lyricism. Like, that's sort of a direction that he started to push in and would continue to do so over the next couple of records. And the reason that I wanted to talk about this one is because, like, this is also the first Tom Waits record that I ever heard. So, like, I remember the feeling of, like, sitting down and putting it on the platter, because it's also the only one I have on vinyl, and, like, just being like, what is this? What's going... What? And so, like, having explored more of his discography, it's like, okay, this makes sense, I guess. Like, going back and listening to the earlier records, having heard the newer ones, like Swordfish Trombones, Rain Dogs, Frank's Wild Years, all that stuff, like, seeing that that's where he went, you can see the seeds of it in the early ones, but I love the image of, like, you know, a fan of that kind of barfly thing putting on this record and being, like, just utterly confused. that's one of my favorite imagined reactions to music. It's the same reason that I love, like, Pure Guava is one of my favorite Ween albums, because, like, Push the Little Daisies became a hit for some reason. So, like, I can imagine people going out and buying the record, being like, yeah, this song's fun, and then, like, you listen to Pure Guava, which is an experience. And, I don't know, I imagine something similar happening here. So that's that one.
Yeah, I remember my first listen of Swordfish Trombones, and I think it was also my first, like, I'm gonna get into some Tom Waits. It throws you a little bit for a loop.
Uh-huh. Like, you get used to it by the end of it, because it's not a short record, but it takes a minute.
Yeah.
Also, I love the idea, like, part of the reason I pulled that quote is, like, I love the idea of, like, I don't know how to play this, let me use this. Like, that's so cool.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of seems like your philosophy as a musician.
Yeah. I mean, my philosophy as a musician, I think I kind of summed it up the other day, was it's like, if I think to myself, I don't know how to play that, then I am misunderstanding the word play.
Right.
So...
Well, I will go ahead and talk about a media that was surprising to me because I didn't know what I was getting into.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about a game called Oxenfree. It's for, computer and all the game consoles through like the Xbox Live or PS Online, whatever sort of communities.
Okay.
It came out in 2016 from a little production company called Night School Studio.
That's a good name.
So it was developed by two people, one of whom had worked a lot with Telltale Games, specifically on the Wolf Among Us. And then another developer who had worked with Disney through a couple of their gaming franchises.
Hmm.
And so it kind of has a little bit of both of those going on.
Okay.
But it is still something altogether different from both of those. Part of the reason this game was so surprising to me was, I don't know if other people, I assume other people have done this. You buy a computer game, and then it sits for, like, months,
mm-hmm.
and then by the time that you get to it, especially with Steam, all you have is the title, and you don't, you're like, yeah, what is this game about again? I don't know, let's play it anyway. That was my experience with Oxenfree. I remember it being a game that was marketed as, like, a storytelling game, and that's really all that I recalled.
Yeah. I've heard of it, but I don't know anything about it.
Well, I picked it up, and I started playing it, and I was immediately surprised, because even after, like, one 45-minute session of playing this game, I found that when I was not playing the game, I was thinking about it. And I find that to be a huge measure of success
yeah.
with a game. That's how they get you, is
keeps
thinking.
You in it. Yeah.
Yeah, like, you're still in the world even when you're not in the world. So the game itself is a 2.5D adventure game. One of those games where it's a 2D, like, setting, but the characters are 3D.
Mm.
So it's set on this island called Edwards Island, and the rough plot is that there's five kids who are in high school, and they've all gone to this island to, like, party down, essentially, and they start discovering some odd things happening on the island,
okay.
and it becomes this sort of supernatural exploration of the island, but also it's very heavily plot-based in that you talk to your other... you play this girl, Alex. The time that you spend talking to the other four characters on the island, that's where, like, the meat of the game actually happens.
Mm-hmm.
There's branching dialogue trees, and there's a great many ways that all of the different dialogues can play out. And in fact, there's actually five different variables as far as the ending of the game goes, where your relationship with each of those other characters changes based on how you talked to them during the game.
Okay.
And there's a couple of choices that you make which affect your own future. So one of the things that gets really fun about this game is you're basically walking around having conversations with your friends, and then something really creepy and inexplicable will happen. What kind of inexplicable? Well, there's extra-dimensional beings, time looping, and World War II secrets. There's a pretty consistent mechanic in the game where you have to use an old transistor radio to tune extra-dimensional frequencies into our dimension by getting them just so that you can see exactly what's going on.
Okay.
There's also a mechanic where people will take pictures and things show up on the pictures after you've already left the scene. And you're like, oh, cool, there was an 8-foot-tall monster there, too.
That's unsettling.
It really is. It's a lot of fun, though. It has absolutely no cutscenes. Everything happens in, like, the game as it occurs.
Mm.
People will talk to you while you're investigating little parts of the map. And it doesn't change. Like, you're completely free to walk around and talk and still be involved in dialogue, which is something I think a lot of games don't do. You have to be standing right in front of your conversation partner in
yeah.
those games to continue a conversation.
Usually.
The way that the developers tried to build this game was, what if Stand By Me met Freaks and Geeks and Spielberg directed it? And
okay.
frankly, having played it, it's not exactly how I would describe it, but it does fit, and I understand why they made the choices they made, if that's what they were going for.
Okay.
Overall, I mean, the game is just, like, it's very genuine, it's heartfelt, it reveals more about human relationships than it does attempt to explore a plot necessarily. And the fact that you have both holding pretty much equal weight is really impressive, I think. And it's the kind of game where I had to stop playing about half an hour before finishing it and then go to work. And basically I spent the entire work day talking to people about Oxenfree. So yeah, I mean, it came as a complete surprise to me. I literally didn't know what I was getting in for, and it turns out it was one of the most enjoyable, creative games I've experienced in quite a while. If you're a fan of, like, a story-based game, with, like, complex relationship dynamics, check this game out. It's gonna be $10 or less if you get it pretty much anywhere. If you get it on sale, it'll be even less.
How long is it?
It takes, like, 3 hours to play through.
That's not too bad.
But due to the different relationship interactions that you can have, cause each conversation has 3 dialogue options, you could easily play through the game 3 times in completion and get a different ending with every variable every time.
Okay. Okay, I think I understood the math of that.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds kind of cool.
Yeah, so, like, check out Oxenfree, folks.
I need to, like, branch out in video gaming, honestly. Like, I got a couple of games, and I was like, yeah, I'm going to play these, and I'm just playing Skyrim again.
It's really tough, because the technology exists and the platform exists to make the games and then sell them cheaply and easily. There's a lot of games out there that just are...
Yeah.
They're not great. I mean, they're good. They're exploring the medium. We're in the, like... foundation phase of video games still becoming a medium.
Still pretty nascent.
Yeah, but there's some really, really good ones out there. I'm sure we'll talk about plenty of them over the course of this podcast.
Right. That is kind of what we do. Okay. Well, so for my second thing, I'm going to talk about a thing that... was more surprising to me personally, but, like, is also, like, this is an interesting left turn. I'm gonna talk about a fellow named David Gordon Green.
Mm-hmm.
So, he's a filmmaker. He's lives in Texas, I think, but, he went to film school in North Carolina, and... by 2008, he had put out 4 movies, 2 of which I've seen and really liked, and the other 2 I haven't seen yet, but they're on my list. So the 2 that I've seen are George Washington, which was his first one. It came out in 2000. It's about, like, a group of small-town kids in, I believe, North Carolina, and, like, an accidental murder, and, like, the Criterion Collection put it out. It's got this, like, hazy kind of... Terrence Malick-y Southern Gothic thing going on. Very, like, it's been a little while since I watched it, but for, like, a long time after I watched it, I was like, oh my god, have you seen this movie? Check it out. The follow-up to that was All the Real Girls in 2003, which is one of those, like, kind of very low-key, somber, ultra-realistic in its way... romantic drama kind of things about, like, a guy in a small town whose, like, best friend's sister comes home from college and he, like, develops a thing for her, but their relationship is weirdly complex and that complicates his relationship with his best friend, and, you know, a very, like, low energy, kind of low key, somber, emotional movie. The 2 that I haven't seen are Undertow from 2004. Which, I guess borrows a lot from, like, Charles Laughton's Night of the Hunter, based on the plot point, but it's about, like, 2 boys being pursued by their, like, murderous uncle who's, like, after their family fortune or something. But, like, again, in kind of a this weird sort of low-key way. And then Snow Angels in 2007, which I believe was the first one that he directed that he didn't write. And it's, you know, intersecting lives in this small town become tragic or an accident. Like, you're feeling a theme here.
Right.
There's a thing going on. So then his next movie was Pineapple Express.
Oh.
So a little bit of a left turn there. Apparently, it took, like, quite a bit of Googling to, like, find out, like, okay, what was the deal? How did that come to be? That someone who has established this, like, very specific kind of style that is very much not that comes to do, arguably the defining film of that, like, Apatow crew kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a debate. There's other ones you could maybe pick, but, like, that's a strong contender, I think. Like, it was one of the biggest ones. I guess what I was finally able to find out was that, he went to college with Danny McBride. And okay. So they knew each other, which is, like, I don't know. I have a soft spot for Danny McBride because, like, we went to the same high school. So, like, every time he comes up, I'm like, hey, you. But anyway.
That is delightful. I had no idea.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, like, that is the only possible claim to fame that my high school has that I can think of. That and, like, a couple of students were murdered by a serial killer in the mid-90s. And that's about it.
Yeah, all my high school has is being equidistant from a juvenile detention center and a garbage dump.
That sounds lovely.
The two nearest buildings to it.
Doesn't that just kind of sum up high school in a nutshell? But anyway. So, being like, he was, according to this kind of like New York Times article that I found called Boldly Going One Toke or More Over the Line. From August 3rd, 2008, by Mark Harris. He was kind of feeling, like, the urge to, like, break out of that style and do something a little bit different anyway. Like, was thinking more like, oh, yeah, let's maybe do, like, an indie comedy or something like that. But his friend Danny McBride was like, hey, I'm working on this movie, Knocked Up. You should, like, come hang out on the set for a minute. And, like, introduced him to Judd Apatow and Seth Rogen and James Franco and, like, all those people. And just kind of got on board with that, and suddenly you have Pineapple Express, which I guess it is 10 years old, so I don't want to say off chance, but on the chance that someone listening who hasn't seen it, it's a movie about weed dealers. I don't know a way to neatly encapsulate it other than that. I think that kind of covers it.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of about the relationship between James Franco and Seth Rogen, but it's also about, like, finding that perfect strain of weed.
Yeah.
And then things, like, get kind of action movie-y.
Yeah, there's, like, a bizarro shootout at the end, if I remember correctly. I was a couple tokes over the line myself last time I watched it. But that's one of my favorite examples because, like, I watched it not realizing that he had directed it,
mm-hmm.
but, like, knowing who he was, and then, like, getting to the, like, you know, a David Gordon Green film and just, like, having to, like, pause it and be like, wait, what? Did I miss something? And, like, when I thought about this topic, like, that was the kind of reaction that I was going for, that just, like, well, I don't, this is not what I thought it was going to be. I don't know what to do with this.
Right.
So I feel like that encapsulates that pretty well.
Yeah, you really had me going there with this David Gordon Green stuff, and then Pineapple Express. I think my eyes got as big as saucers.
Yeah, you did kind of start up a little.
Well, I just have to imagine the person who was, like, fucking love Pineapple Express. I gotta see the other stuff this director has done.
Right, yeah, going the other way.
Undertow.
Mm-hmm. Or like George Washington, where it's like, yeah, here's a long stretch of silence and some pretty trees.
And then some, like, mumbled naturalistic dialogue. And then a shot of a canal.
That's delightful.
Yeah. Washington is a really good movie, though. Like, All the Real Girls is good, but George Washington's better. So I would recommend that if you haven't seen it.
Speaking of George Washington.
Oh. Segway.
Segway is seamless. I want to talk about a book. A book that is full of surprises. This book is called Lies My Teacher Told Me.
Mm.
Basically, in 1995, a sociologist by the name of James Lowen, I believe it's pronounced.
Okay.
Multiple vowels in there. James Lowen basically said, I teach I teach college history, and the people come into my classroom just out of high school, know nothing about history. Not only do they know nothing, most of what they were taught appears to have been complete bullshit. So, he did this study. He went out and he got the 12 most popular high school history textbooks,
mm-hmm.
and he read all of them. And isolated all the things that are not true, and the things that are, like, across the board being told that are not true, the things that people should be giving history on and are not. And he wrote this book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, which sets the record straight and addresses a lot of the issues with the textbook industry.
Okay. Now I'm curious.
He re-released this book in 2008. And he added another 6 textbooks. So it's a pretty comprehensive look at the way that American kids get taught history. The introduction that he gives to the book is, I think, the most effective way to get somebody's interest piqued in it, so I'm just going to share a little bit of you. He talks about going into a classroom and saying to all of his students, who can tell me about Helen Keller? And invariably, like, half the hands in class rise, and when he calls on somebody, they give him the whole story of the miracle worker.
Yeah, like I was going to say, that's my reference point.
Right. He goes, okay, did you know that she was once a personal enemy of Woodrow Wilson?
No, but that's awesome.
Yeah, as it turns out, Helen Keller was, like, one of the most vocal proponents of socialism in the United States for most of her adult life.
Hmm.
She actively campaigned for, like, getting along with the Soviet Union. She was one of the foremost voices of women's rights. She organized marches. She did just about everything that she could to be a thorn in the side of his presidential administration. Because she just believed genuinely and wholeheartedly in, like, well, I mean, socialism and like, equal rights. She even, for a brief time, was, like, a black rights proponent. And he goes, okay, so how is it that we have one of the most, like, vocal voices in all of American descent for this period of American history, and we don't remember her for anything except for running water over her hands so she'd learn what water was?
Yep.
Because this is the point. This is the point. There's so many fascinating stories in history, so real important truth that's out there that people aren't getting. And not only would it make them more interested in history, it would make them better citizens. They'd know what's going on. So this is his sort of his quest with the book. And reading a lot of it is a little bit exhausting because you're doing so much unlearning and then relearning. For a whole bunch of people in this country, the middle third of the book is going to be the most difficult because it's largely, this is what we actually did to the Native Americans, this is what the slave trade was actually like, and this is what the Columbian Exchange was actually like.
Yeah.
And if you don't know what those things are, boy, this book is going to be a fucking surprise for you. This is why people don't like white people, basically, what it boils down to at a certain point.
Or at least America's part in that.
A couple other interesting surprises. In 90% of textbooks, there's as much space given to the War of 1812 as there is to the Vietnam War, despite the fact that the Vietnam War lasted 20 fucking years, and that the War of 1812 was actually just a naval branch of the Napoleonic Wars that the United States barely remembers it was involved in.
Yeah, I remember that being a big deal for some reason, and even when I was learning about it, not really understanding why.
No. There's the level of misrepresentation in history that gets really surprising. Like, John Brown, people know John Brown from the Civil War era for being the guy who went nuts and chopped up a bunch of slave keepers in Missouri.
Okay.
And the thing that gets misrepresented is, in hindsight, we go, oh, everybody knew he was crazy at the time, and that's why we dismiss him now, because he was crazy. When in reality, most abolitionists were like, yeah, John Brown was justified, and pretty much the entire black community idolized John Brown, because what he was doing was sincere pursuit of the abolitionist cause. It was extreme, but the way that we remember his legacy is completely changed.
Quick just tangent, because it's occurring to me. John Brown's body is a phrase that's in my head, and I can't think of what that actually refers to.
It's a song that was written in, like, the aftermath of John Brown being hanged for his actions.
Okay.
Basically, it became an abolitionist cause. John Brown's body is moldering in the grave, I believe. Mm.
I just think of the Far Side cartoon, John Brown's body and Fender Shop.
I love that. So then there's also the issues with the textbook industry itself. For instance, a lot of books outright plagiarize each other, and it's difficult to figure out who's plagiarizing who, but he'll put side-by-side comparisons of text, and literally all they're doing is, like, moving periods around.
Which sounds like a problem for history.
Yeah.
Ba-dum-tsh. Anyway.
Another thing which becomes a serious issue is the sheer level of control that Texas has over the textbook industry.
Hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't have thought about that.
But the reason that exists is Texas buy textbooks that are largely revisionist and whitewash a lot of important things. This means that if they don't have enough textbooks for Texas that are like that, textbook sellers will not be able to sell all of the potential books they could to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
They have plenty of incentive, however, to make as many revisionist textbooks as they want, because other states will buy them too. Which means that Texas basically gets to decide what about a third of the country learns in history classes. And, I mean, I'm going to try to put this sensitively. There are few states I can imagine I would like to have that much of a say in the textbook industry as Texas.
Yeah. This is a broad general, but just from what I know about Texas's history is they seem to have a thing about that.
They do. So
the joke was they were their own country for a while and never forgot it.
Yeah. Well, you know what they say. The stars at night are big and bright. Clap, 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 clap. Way in the heart of Texas. So, yeah, Lies My Teacher Told Me is an interesting book, even if you're not trying to learn about history necessarily. It's an eye-opening look at American culture in a lot of ways. It also will teach you a handful of things which the way that I think about it is sometimes when you learn history, you go, oh, okay, that's something that I'm going to have to remember. And you don't really have a framework to connect it to.
Mm.
Yeah. Learn true history, the response that you have is almost always, oh, well, that explains like 8 things about the way that the world is now, or the rest of the way that history played out.
Yeah.
I'm not going to have a hard time remembering that.
It's like about the way it's connected, not the event itself.
Exactly. All of Lies My Teacher Told Me is like that, where you go, oh, well, it didn't make sense before, but I get it now. if you want some non-whitewashed history, you want some really colorful takes on what actually happened and how it affects us now, check out Lies My Teacher Told Me.
Was that intentional? Non-whitewashed and colorful?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. I thought it might be.
This is going to be a very punny episode. I have a couple lined up for the next one.
Okay. So, a somewhat unusual. My kind of approach to this episode was a little bit narrow, because usually I do the thing where it's like I try to interpret the topic in as different ways if I can, whereas like with this one I was going for like that particular feeling of like, wait, this is not what I thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. Like, that experience itself. And that was a difficult thing to come up with. And so my third thing, which is also a book, is probably the one that I have the least to say about, just because it's been quite some time since I read it. But I think it fits both in my experience reading it and kind of in the general sense of, like, here's an artist who did something a little different with this one. I'm going to talk about Stephen King.
Okay.
And prolific motherfucker that he is, by the early 80s, he had, like, more than a dozen novels published. And so this that I'm about to relate comes from the inspiration section about this book on StephenKing.com. So as straight from the horse's mouth as I can get. But basically, he talks about the fact that his daughter, who I think is named Naomi, was, like, really not into his shit. It's like, yeah, werewolves, vampires, telekinetic little girls who set shit on fire, whatever. It's fine. I don't care. So he was like, all right, you know what? I'm gonna write a story that you'd like. And kind of started basically with the idea of Once Upon a Time.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how we ended up with The Eyes of the Dragon, which was published in... First published in, like, I guess kind of a limited edition in 1984, and then, like, mass market published in 1984. It's a high fantasy book, basically. The plot follows, like, this evil wizard guy who's, like, trying to take over the kingdom and shit, and in order to do that, murders the king and frames the prince for it, but, like, the other prince is all, like, spying on him and, like, helps his brother break out of the tower, and I don't know, like I said, it's been a while, and there's, like, it's, you know, almost 400 pages, so presumably some other stuff happens. What I do remember is, like, getting it out of the library when I was about 12, and being a little suspicious of it, because I'd read 2 other, I think, Stephen King books at that point. I tried to read The Shining and was just, like, not feeling it, because I was, like, 11.
This is fair.
And then I read Salem's Lot, which, like, freaked the bejesus out of me. Vampires have always been my favorite monster. So I got this book out, and I was, like, after being, like, all freaked out by Salem's Lot, I was like, I don't know if I want to do more of that. But I really loved, like, Lloyd Alexander's Prydain Chronicles growing up, and the Redwall series, and, like, kind of Lord of the Rings, but more, like, having that read to me by my mom and be talking about it, because it's a difficult book to read.
but like was into that. So like this was like, all right, some like high fantasy stuff. All right, I'll check it out. And like I got really into it, and like that sort of led to like, all right, I'll give more Stephen King a chance. That reaction was apparently a little bit perhaps unusual. Reportedly, and again, I don't know to what degree this is apocrypha, but it's something I found on a couple of places on the internet, that like while The Eyes of the Dragon was critically reasonably received, a lot of fans were kind of weirded out by it because it was not a horror book.
Mm-hmm.
And like we're just like, well, why don't you do what you normally do? Do that. We like that. And that reaction was purportedly the inspiration for Misery. So
that puts that in context.
Yeah. So that's kind of cool. Also, like, I think Dragon is important because it was probably written around the same time as The Gunslinger, but definitely before The Drawing of the Three. And I think like the sort of the high fantasy aspect of it really fed a lot into what The Dark Tower became as it went on. Which, for anybody not familiar, The Dark Tower is like Stephen King's magnum opus. It's like a 7-book series that ostensibly like ties all of his other fiction together in like, you know, a pseudo Asimov kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that is that the evil wizard in Eyes of the Dragon is a character that shows up in a couple of other books. Most notably, he is the villain of The Stand. Randall Flagg. I think he's just called Flagg in Eyes of the Dragon, but in The Stand it's Randall Flagg. He's also like one of the mains in The Dark Tower, including, I think most especially, Book 4, The Wizard in Glass, which is the other like high fantasy book Stephen King wrote. Yeah. Sort of ran out of steam there, I guess, but when you think Stephen King, like, this is not what you think of, and that's why it's one of my favorites of his.
Yeah.
So.
I kind of went a similar... Well, okay, so my last example is surprising in a couple of ways. One, it surprised me when I saw it, because I was sold on this movie in a very particular way by someone whose movie taste I don't always trust.
Oh, those are always fun.
Secondly, it constantly changes and evolves in terms of the type of story it's telling. So you're constantly surprised by the choices the movie is making.
Mm.
And then it's also surprising in that way where, like, this is what the creator did? And what I'm talking about is the movie The Way of the Gun.
Okay.
So in 2000, Christopher McQuarrie, who wrote The Usual Suspects.
That's why I know that name.
So Usual Suspects had come out, and McQuarrie, the story goes, he wanted to make a movie with complete creative control, and he figured he'd be able to be paid handsomely for it, what with the success of The Usual Suspects.
Which was a damn fine movie.
And he spent 3 years getting rejected by studios when he would ask them for complete creative control. Finally, he found a studio, and I forget which studio. Cool, I'm going to make this movie. It's going to be whatever I want. They said, yeah, sure. I mean, you did Usual Suspects. By the way, Christopher McQuarrie would go on to direct Jack Reacher, and a really entertaining, but not great necessarily, TV show called Persons Unknown.
Okay.
Watched it when it came out. It was about this town where people woke up in the town and they couldn't leave for some reason. And They weren't sure why they were there. And so it was basically just them trying to escape for, like, the whole show.
Okay. I mean, you could do something cool with that.
It was fun. Okay. They ended it on a note where it was like, oh, you were trying for a second season and you definitely didn't get one, did you?
Wah-wah.
So this movie, The Way of the Gun, I want to talk about how it opens. McQuarrie wanted to establish the low-life people, these two main characters. They're just absolute low-lifes, and they don't care about the consequences of their actions. They just want to do what they're going to do. So it starts with them, like, sitting in a parking lot, and they're, like, chain-smoking cigarettes, and Sarah Silverman comes out of a building, and she starts being loud and obnoxious, because that's what they asked her to do.
Mm-hmm. I imagine she could oblige.
And so the two main characters, who are, by the way, played by Ryan Phillippe and Benicio Del Toro as very young men.
Okay.
Start yelling at her to shut up.
This is already a really weird cast.
It's gonna get weirder, I promise. So they start yelling at her, and she basically tells them to fuck off, and she can say whatever she wants, wherever she wants. And they start threatening her. Her 20 friends come out to confront the two of them. And they have a choice. Like, they can walk away from the confrontation and not get their asses kicked by 20 strangers.
Or
they can jump into the fight. So Ryan Phillippe punches Sarah Silverman in the face, and they take the beating of their fucking lives.
That sounds...
Title card, start movie.
Yeah, I don't even know where you'd go from that.
Well, it goes here. The next time you see them, they're in a sperm bank trying to make money, and they hear that some woman is being paid, like, $100,000 to carry a child. So they hatch the most logical plan, which is kidnap her and hold her for ransom. Because if the dude's in a pair, $100,000 to carry a baby, clearly he's got money around. So it becomes, like, a heist movie.
Stupidest plan I've ever heard.
It becomes a heist movie where the thing that they're heisting is a pregnant woman. Are you ready for it to get weirder?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe.
They're mostly being chased by a bodyguard played by Taye Diggs and a bagman played by James Caan.
What?
Yes. Everything that you're hearing...
That's... like, the weirdest buddy cop movie I can think of.
They're not exactly partners. James Caan gets to deliver this line, which is just one of my favorite things in the whole movie. And he does it with all of the gravitas that, like, James Caan can.
Yeah.
I can promise you a day of reckoning you will not live long enough to never forget.
Oh god, I choked on that one.
it's a movie... It has... despite all of the stuff that I'm talking about, where, like, it has this ridiculous shit... There's a car chase where the cars never go over 10 miles an hour. At one point, like, it becomes this really emotional movie where they're like, maybe we should let her go. She's having a rough go of it, you know, man? Here's a fun thing. The two main characters almost never talk, and they certainly almost never talk to each other.
Hmm.
They are named Parker and Longbaugh, which are the real names of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and they're kind of modeled in, like, weird underbelly of the world ways. Sure. On Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. The whole movie was just kind of McQuarrie saying, what if you took completely unsympathetic main characters and made them do things that made them completely unsympathetic? And it is surprising, a very heartfelt movie in some portions, but it's always got this beautiful attention to detail. Like, I believe it was McQuarrie's directorial debut, and I've seen it like 3 times now, and every single time I'm impressed by the level of attention to detail that he puts into just everything about it. It's a movie that feels very warm and very cold at the same time. And I appreciate that about it.
Another just kind of quick tangent, but, like, that's interesting but not entirely surprising to me, because I always like to look at, like, first-time directors who have, like, made movies as other things before, and it's like, what do you bring to this? And, like, screenwriters seem to be very obsessive.
Yes. Well, really, one of the things that's very surprising to me is how little Benicio del Toro and Ryan Phillippe talk. Like, you look at The Usual Suspects, and it's a very verbal movie, but tish.
Yeah.
And I would say, without exaggeration, there's probably a dozen lines between them in the whole movie. It's all about the action and the way that they move. So, if you're looking for a movie, and I know I said a bunch of things that are surprising, there's still more surprises in the movie, which I'm not going to give away. It's a very surprising film. It was the only example, actually, that I was like, oh, surprising? And I thought about it for like 2 minutes, and I was like, oh, well, Way of the Gun.
Okay.
And then the other two were a little bit harder to think through.
Yeah,
Taye Diggs and James Caan.
Yeah, just... God bless a movie with a weird-ass cast. Like, I love those. Like, people you'd never imagine in the same film. I'm trying to think of, like, another really good example.
Juliette Lewis is also in that movie?
Sold. Yeah, most of the examples I'm thinking of are, like, really big casts, like JFK.
Oh, sure.
But, anyway, maybe that could be, like, a future thing, like...
A surprising cast?
Yeah, like, it would have to be, like, a movie or TV-centric one, but, like...
Right.
I don't know.
You could even get video games in there, depending on
That's
the voice
true.
Acting cast.
That's true.
I mean, shit, you got Liam Neeson in a Fallout game, you got Patrick Stewart in an Elder Scrolls game.
Right. Kate Mulgrew in Dragon Age.
You have Chris Hardwick in a friggin' Telltale game.
Yeah.
It's pretty weird.
Didn't Ellen Page do that one?
Oh, God, yeah, she's, like, the star of Beyond Good and Evil.
And, like, Norman Reedus is doing something with... Oh, God. I think the guy who made the Metal Gear Solid games... I'm not sure, but it looks crazy as hell. I know that.
That's par for the course.
Yeah, he seems like a weird dude. The Metal Gear Solid guy. Probably Norman Reedus, too, but... Which, you know, is not meant to be disparaging in any way. Weird people are... I'm giving a thumbs up right now. I just kind of realized that you can't see that, but that's what's happening.
Solely audio medium. What's our body language?
Yeah. It makes me think of the old Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, like, BBC movie.
Mm.
Have you ever seen that?
I've seen clips.
I have it on VHS. We should watch it at some point. It's, like, 3 hours long, but I love it. And one of the things that I love about it is that, like, this is clearly the script from the radio program. And, like, it's not immediately obvious, but, like, at a certain point, you're like, wait, they're just describing everything that's happening. Like, nothing happens that they don't say aloud. So it's like, oh, there go my legs floating off into the sunset. And it's, you know, you see that with, like, a budget that looks like what they found in their couch. It's lovely. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it seems... every time I've seen, like, a clip or a still from it, I'm like, this is television?
I know. It's... I mean, it was 1981. What are you gonna
yeah.
do?
Yeah, fair.
All right. Fun stuff this week.
Yeah, weekly recommendations.
I got a couple.
Yeah, I've got a couple, but there's one that's really stuck out to me.
All right, what is it?
Found this new musician. I don't know exactly when she put this EP out, but all that she has put so far is an EP. Her name is Alice Merton. There's a song that's been making the rounds on YouTube, at least that's where I picked it up from. It's called No Roots.
Yeah.
And that song is to it.
Yeah, a little bit of a stomp.
Whereas the rest of the EP is more kind of grungy Florence and the Machines. Like, she's got that weird Adele voice, but there's a certain, like... the rock to it that you definitely don't get with Adele and even with the Florence and the Machines.
Yeah.
So check out Alice Merton. The EP is called No Roots. All four of the songs on it are fantastic. it's been making me very happy to sort of bounce around to like these bass lines, and I'm finding it very difficult to not pay attention to drums specifically when I listen to music now, because I've been learning drums, and all of her drummer is very dynamic. I appreciate that about the music.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Yeah, a couple. I think the one that kind of stands out the most is that Kat and I finally got around to starting Atlanta.
Oh.
Which, I knew pretty much nothing about going in. I was like, everything I know about Donald Glover I like,
mm-hmm.
so let's see what this is. And I still don't know exactly what it is. Because, like, it's a half hour and it's definitely very funny, but I don't know if I call it a comedy. I mean, we're only, like, a couple episodes in, so, like, I still don't quite know what to make of it, but I like that about it a lot. It's very sharply written. It is very funny. It's very... just, like, I mean, television is... becoming much more cinematic now, but like this is a really particular example of that. Like, there's some really amazing shots in it, like just the way the camera moves around. Like, I dig it. The other thing that I was thinking of when I was like on my way over here trying to think of things was a song by a guy whose name that I've looked up like four times now and keep forgetting. Mike is his name. Kind of like I think he's based in Vermont, sort of like a weird acid folk rock guy, like, you know, put out an album with the Holy Moly Rounders and a couple other people. But in particular, I'm pointing at his 1977 album Long Journey, and the second track on it, which is called Portland Water, and the sort of refrain of which is like, called up Portland Water on the public telephone, they said it's raining in the state of Oregon or something like that. And like, that's just been stuck in my head all week because it has been raining.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, it's wont to do.
It's Portland.
Yep. It's hailing earlier.
Yeah, just for a minute.
I know.
I'm like, hey, you ready? Is that hail?
Yeah, it's like, all right, let's get a little bit of winter in, then we'll go back to summer, then we'll do spring for a second.
Yeah.
That's how I do.
Yeah, so what's our topic next week?
Oh man, I don't know. There was one that I had on the list that I think might have, like, a little bit of wiggle room in it. It is, like, sort of more specifically thematic than we've been doing heretofore, but, like, what are some of your favorite depictions of time travel? Because that leaves open to a couple different possible media and interpretations thereof.
This is true. I'm down to try it.
It's worth a shot. So yes, next time we will travel through time, I guess.
I already know one of my answers.
I don't, but I will get there. Actually, no, I have one that I like.
Well, thanks for listening, folks. This has been another smashing success of an episode of Does It Matter? When we're back next week.
Yeah.
I'm so excited. So this is like a little tidbit. We finally now in the, as of this seventh episode of the podcast.
It's seven already, Jesus.
Depending on whether or not we count the first one.
Oh. I don't know if I would.
Yeah, I don't know. I've lost count somewhere along the line. This might be seven. We now have a website, we can start posting.
Yeah, the first one's actually on the internet. So someone might potentially hear it.
Yeah, this isn't just like an exercise anymore. It's real.
It's weird. Have you gone back and listened to any of them?
I haven't. I've only got, like, the last four episodes on my computer.
Yeah, I tried to, like, listen to that one when I uploaded it, but just, you know, listening to myself talk is weird.
So, when I was doing my D&D podcast, we would do 3-hour episodes every week. And then I would go back and listen to each episode and write down all of the significant plot points. It would form this, like, big double paragraph for each episode. Because, I mean, there's a lot in 3 hours, usually.
Yeah.
And...
unless it's combat.
We did 180 hours of this show by the time that we were done.
Jesus.
It's a lot of time to listen to yourself DM. I'll say that much. Drove me a little crazy.
I want to get that from you again, because I had it on my computer, and then my computer committed suicide. So, at some point...
certainly.
We're just rambling now.
We are. Thanks for listening, folks.
Yep.
Take care.
See you next time.